Welcome to Perspectives. I'm Joan Herman. My guest today is Oregon State Representative Tiffany Mitchell, who recently completed her first legislative session representing the 32nd District, which encompasses all of Clatsop County, most of Tillamook County, and a small section of Washington County. The progressive Democrat and recent state social service worker campaigned on a platform of serving working-class Oregonians. She identified affordable housing and health care, as well as quality education, as key issues during the campaign. Her first term was not without controversy, as she faced a number of angry state workers for her vote to reform the public employee retirement system. Likewise, many in the local wood products and fishing industries were upset with her vote for House Bill 2020 to limit greenhouse gases, also called the Cap and Trade Bill. The bill failed, but inspired formation of the Timber Unity Group and mention of a possible recall attempt for both Governor Kate Brown and Mitchell. This program was pre-recorded. Welcome to the studio, Representative Mitchell.
Thank you for having me, Joan. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thanks. Tell us how it feels to have completed your first 7 months in office in your first session.
I would say it's really relieving to not have to live in Salem 4 to 5 days a week. But honestly, it's actually just really great to be out. And you mentioned some contention that surrounded kind of the end of the session that I try not to focus on quite so much, because in hindsight, we actually did a whole lot for working Oregonians. And honestly, looking back, that is something that I am incredibly proud of. And this is a session for the history books and one that was just amazing.
Well, that's a great place to start then. Let's start with the good stuff. What are you most proud of?
I am most proud of the fact that when I campaigned for this position, like you said, the three big things that I really focused on and worried about were healthcare issues, housing and affordable housing, and education. And in my first session, I feel like I delivered on all three of those with some fairly large wins. When we start talking about housing, Senate Bill 608, which got rid of no-cause tenant evictions, meaning you can't just throw somebody out of their home for no reason. And it also implemented the first of its kind statewide rent control, which is very different than the way that rent control has been implemented in the past in other jurisdictions. Additionally, the rent control piece that we have here follows the tenant as opposed to the unit itself, which creates a whole bunch of other mechanisms that actually protects both the landlord and the tenant within that process. So that's one huge thing that we were able to accomplish in terms of housing. In terms of healthcare, we were able to do a number of things in terms of changing how pharmaceutical manufacturers have to market and certain things that they have to make sure that they say in relation to the drugs that they create. There was also some movement on a bill that would make it so that insulin could actually be prescribed in emergency situations by a pharmacist. So let's say, for example, you break a vial of insulin and you need that because you're diabetic, and you, for whatever reason, can't get into your doctor to get an emergency prescription for that, you can go to a pharmacist and get that prescription so that you can get that life-saving bridge of medication until either you can get an okay from your insurance company or a new prescription from your doctor. We also were able to, as far as education goes, student success, the Student Success Act, which was a monumental investment in education in the state of Oregon. It's a $2 billion investment over a biennium into Oregon's education system to make sure that we can finally start having more school days, we can pay our teachers appropriately, and we can give our kids the education that they deserve.
Now, I understand that the Student Success Act, I'll start with that one first, will provide quite a bit of money to local schools throughout the county. Do you know offhand how much specifically?
I don't know exactly how much is going to be going into our locality, but it will be a significant amount. And I can tell you that the amounts that are divvied out across the state really are dependent on how much help a specific district needs. Now, regardless, it will still be significant. But one of the real key features to the Student Success Act that we're really proud of is the idea that if you have a school district that might be struggling, or a specific school that is struggling, with a system like No Child Left Behind, as an example, as an incentive, they would take that money away until grades improved or test scores improved. And as we saw, that doesn't necessarily happen. When you take away resources, it actually just becomes much harder to give that help to struggling students in order to improve. In the case of the Student Success Act, we will be working very closely with these struggling school districts to make sure that they implement a plan that works for them, that helps get them to their goals, rather than taking those resources away.
And I don't want to say something that's incorrect, but I thought I had heard more than $1 million going into the Astoria School District coffers.
And that part is correct, yes. I just don't have an exact number for you. So.
And I also had heard, as you just mentioned, that local school districts get to decide how they feel the money is most needed.
And that is also true. There are essentially three different buckets under which it sort of has to be spent, and that can be anything from teacher salaries to other things that for example, investing into vocational training programs within the schools. One of the things that I've heard that the Astoria School District might be interested in doing is investing into mental health resources and having health programs established actually on campus. And that is all very, very important to making sure that our kids are able to get through school in a safe and healthy way, especially when it comes to their mental state. So.
And how is that big bill funded?
That bill is funded through a modified corporate activities tax. I know that the scary word is tax there, but the truth is that Oregon has been underfunding its school system for over 30 years now, and this is the first time in 30 years that we have been able to substantively raise revenue. And there's the argument of, cutting here and cutting there and constantly tightening the belt, but at some point, you really can't tighten anymore and expect to see any meaningful gains. We have to invest in the things that we think are important, and educating our kids and giving them every chance to succeed in life should be the thing that we invest in. And so through this modified corporate activities tax, we're finally going to be able to do that. One of the really lovely things about the way that this is structured, I feel, is that it really focuses on making sure that the folks who perhaps were maybe scuttling their responsibility a little bit in terms of taxes, it really focuses on trying to make sure that they are paying their fair share in taxes as opposed to regular Oregonians like you and me. For example, it only applies to businesses that make over $1 million, and those businesses that make over $1 million, the tax only applies to products sold in Oregon after that first million. So if you have, for example, a small business that makes $1 million and they think that they might, or just over that, and they think they have to pay on the whole thing, they don't. It's anything over that first million. Additionally, groceries are exempt, fuel is exempt. So we really, I think, have crafted something that is aimed at making sure that the people that we want to be paying that pay it without being necessarily overly regressive.
Moving back to the housing bill, I spoke with a couple local housing providers, as they prefer to be called, rather than landlords, and they felt that the new law, which I believe is at the first or second of its kind in the nation, rent control, that rents can't rise more than 7% for the same tenant as long as they don't move out of a specific rented place. They felt that was punishing them for providing housing and doesn't take into account all of their fixed costs that they have to endure. So they kind of feel like they've been thrown under the bus. How would you respond to that?
I would respond. So we heard a lot of, I was actually on the Human Services and House Human Services and Housing Committee with the Oregon Legislature and the House side, and was able to sit through testimony on this bill as it was moving through committee. And this is something that we heard multiple times from people who were housing providers. And one of the things that I was really struck with in hearing that testimony is people who were committed to their tenants and doing everything that they very possibly could to keep up with those costs. But then they would also keep saying, like, you know, I really do everything I can to not raise my rent more than 1 to maybe 3% per year. And so I finally asked one of them on record, if you are not currently raising your rent 7% every year, plus the cost of living, how does this negatively impact you to all of a sudden now have this limitation? And the response that I got was, we just don't trust you to change it. And to me, this is really about making sure that we prevent spikes, massive spikes in rent. We're not saying that you as a business owner and as a housing provider, it is your business if that's the business that you choose to be in. We're not saying you can't raise your rent to cover your expenses. That is something that you should be able to do. Now, that said, you are providing housing for an individual, and we should have some sort of expectation and protection for them that they can afford that housing. And as any business owner who responsibly operates, if your costs go up, you should be raising your rent maybe a little bit every year to cover that, as opposed to waiting until something massive goes wrong and then raising the rent, for example, that 7% all at one time. And if there's anything that, you know, a housing provider would like to discuss with me in terms of how maybe we change things in the future to make it easier for them, I'm happy to hear that. But overall, I feel like this bill was incredibly well negotiated to try to make sure that we found that happy medium that allows housing providers or landlords to operate their businesses while at the same time protecting tenants.
What would you say was your biggest disappointment during this session?
Perhaps my biggest disappointment was House Bill 2020. And that's for a number of reasons.
And remind everyone what that was.
House Bill 2020 was the cap and trade bill. The cap and trade bill, because it didn't pass, was a disappointment, but also really what its non-passage represents for two reasons. The first being the fact that we did have a walkout of elected senators.
Republican senators.
Republican senators that just didn't want to vote on the bill, and they felt like that was their only way to get us to listen. In truth, even though I know there has been a narrative out there that this was thrown through the legislature, that nobody listened to anybody else, that couldn't be further from the truth. We had a joint committee on carbon that worked very hard and listened to all stakeholders. They did a whole roadshow across the state to listen to different people, especially in rural areas, about their concerns. And a number of things were incorporated into this bill to try to make it something that would help us achieve our goals, but at the same time, not necessarily harm our communities. One of those big issues that was thrown in that I think is great is a specific investment into rural and coastal communities, very specifically because as a smaller area, we'll have fewer resources to both talk about adaptation costs when climate change finally, when the worst parts of climate change finally hits, and also any potential negative impacts that this bill might have. So that was one thing that I thought was great. There were a number of exemptions for different industries that could potentially be impacted. For example, forestry was not, they were exempted from that bill.
How so?
So as an example, there were these forest carbon offsets, which would essentially assign like a financial value to trees and the carbon that they that they sequester.
That they don't cut down.
Yeah. So basically, it would just allow them to use that as offsets within the program that could then be bought, say, for example, by one of the regulated entities that is required to purchase offsets. They could then purchase those offsets from those those projects and use that as basically their way of continuing to do their business and have that. So one of the things that was built into the bill was that, A, if you're a state forest, you couldn't participate for so many years in that. It would only be private landowners. And then secondly, that it couldn't impact negatively fiber supply. So when we start talking about people who were really anxious about how this might potentially impact their jobs, there were a number of things built into that bill to try to make sure that we were impacting them as little as possible.
If you're just joining me, you're listening to a pre-recorded interview with historian and Oregon State Representative Tiffany Mitchell, who just completed her first legislative session representing District 32, which covers all of Clatsop County, most of Tillamook County, and a small section of Washington County. I'm Joan Herman on Perspectives on Coast Community Radio, KMUN Astoria, 91.9 FM, and KTCB Tillamook, 89.5 FM. Getting back to the cap and trade bill, a lot of our economy, of course, our local economy is based on the timber and fishing industries. And there's a lot of mistrust, one, with state government in general. I think that's human nature to mistrust our government and those who take our tax dollars. But also a big concern that, say, a company such as Georgia Pacific, which owns probably the biggest employer in the area, the Wana Mill, east of on the eastern edge of Clatsop County, that they might, you know, any increased costs, they might just move up and to a different state where they didn't have such a tax. How do you respond to those concerns?
So Georgia Pacific is an example of how House Bill 2020 was really well negotiated to try to take into consideration companies like them and some of their very unique specific concerns. So Georgia Pacific is what is considered an energy intense trade exposed organization. They are really subject to a lot of external pressures worldwide that make it very difficult for them to operate. Now, that said, Georgia Pacific had been in my office a number of times talking about how they really appreciated, even though they are one of the biggest polluters in the state of Oregon, they really put a lot of focus and energy into trying to be as green as possible. They have a generator, they burn a lot of biomass, they try to really recycle a lot of their waste and try their best to be as green as they possibly can. And when you have a large organization like that coming to you and saying, like, we're doing everything we possibly can, and we might leave because of this, that was a concern that I had brought to one of the bill's chief sponsors and one of the co-chairs on, she was on the Carbon Committee, Representative Karen Power, one of the authors of the bill. She wasn't a co-chair. And said, you know, my mill, Wana Mill, is really concerned about this. How do we try to address their concerns? How can we push them any further than they can possibly go? And there was a huge evolution from the first iteration of the bill to the end. The final iteration of the bill would have given free allowances for the first number of years in the bill to Wana Mill and other EITEs, and then would have only made them responsible for about 5% of their offsets, so long as they continued to maintain the best available technology, because that's what the Wana Mill and many of these organizations claim that they were doing. We wanted to reward that investment into good behavior, at the same time still wanting to achieve our end goals.
Legislative terms or representative terms are only 2 years, and I know you've just finished your first session, but I would imagine you must already be thinking about, do I want to run again? Based on your experience so far, what are you thinking?
I definitely want to run again because I feel like there's still a lot more that needs to be done. And I think that there is value in my perspective at the Capitol that wasn't necessarily there before. And just I feel like I I bring a working class perspective that so many folks who are in the Capitol, a lot of great, amazing people, but the backgrounds that they come from are not necessarily as diverse as someone who, for example, had to work full time and all of that so recently in their past, to where they understand and realize and remember what that was like and how hard it is for people out there, and how much, you know, a huge medical bill can really impact somebody's ability to pay their rent or their mortgage payment. And that's a perspective that I think is important to keep in the Capitol and one that I intend to make sure stays at the Capitol.
For just a sec, I want to return to House Bill 2020, the cap and trade bill. The Timber Unity Group, of course, I think most of us around here have heard of it now, grew out of that bill in opposition to the bill. And they, as I mentioned at the top of the show, have uttered the word recall around Governor Kate Brown, as well as you. What do you think of that? Does that concern you at all?
I haven't seen anything formal filed yet about a recall for me. And if they want to do that, then they're more than welcome to try to do that, because that is within their rights as a citizen. It's only concerning to me in that there are a lot of really important things in the interim that I am also trying to accomplish for our community. For example, getting together a work group on mental health and trying to make mental health treatment more accessible to folks in our area, because we just really lack those resources. And even though they are well within their rights to do that, it provides an additional distraction for someone who is really trying to do everything they can to represent the people well here. And they're within their rights to do that, but let's try to get through the first session of getting through the job. And then if you want to run someone against me, I think that would probably be the more productive thing to do, rather than try to do it at this juncture. So particularly because, especially if the one thing you're going to be really angry with me about is House Bill 2020, that bill passed out of the House with 36 votes. It only needed 31. So even without my vote, it would have passed. And with an elected official, you're always going to be mad at them for one thing or another. You have to look at things in the broad context and say, is this person representing me on all these other issues and doing a good job there? If they disagree, then I'd say, you know, rally around a candidate in the next election cycle. It would probably be more productive.
Another bill, of course, I say of course, that angered some local constituents is your vote to reform the public employee retirement system, also known as PERS, which every public employee in the state, or pretty much every, belongs to. And not long after, I mean, just a few days, I believe, that you took that vote, you faced an angry town hall. How do you brace yourself for facing a group, not everybody was angry, but a group of people who are?
It was good practice for a town hall I had a couple weeks ago about House Bill 2020 and facing another angry group of people. And all I can say is I had to prepare myself knowing that all I could do was be honest about why I made that decision. It's not a surprise that many people know that I was supported a lot by labor in my race. I am a former SEIU member. I still consider myself in my heart to be an SEIU member. That's where how I feel, because I really care about wanting to ensure that working class people have a real shot.
The State Employee Union?
State Employee Union is SEIU. They also represent a bunch of other different employees throughout the state in different areas as well. But they are the biggest, they are the biggest union of public employees in the state of Oregon. And to take that vote was really tremendously difficult and was not done without a lot of research on my part, talking with the people over at PERS to really get a good idea of what that situation was and realizing that the information that I had previous to going into office was not all the information that I needed to make a good decision. And we were faced with a number of different things that complicated that vote going into it, from the fact that there was a real risk to having an initiative on the ballot to reform PERS, which is still potentially going forward at this point. We wanted to neuter that threat as much as possible by saying, like, look, we're actually doing something about this right now. We take this seriously, because we didn't want what those initiatives will end up doing, which is creating a 401k system for public employees. We wanted to preserve that as much as possible. Secondly, we wanted to make sure that we tried to reduce the rate that employer rates would go up every year, because what that was ending up potentially going to do is really harming the ability for our public employers to be able to keep these employees on. We were potentially going to see massive layoffs as a result of that. And then finally, the long-term stability of the pension system overall was a huge concern for me. And just taking all of that into consideration and knowing that public pension systems are not immune from ever possibly being threatened in that way, it was really important to vote for that bill as the smallest, least impactful thing we could do to reform the system.
I know we are just about out of time, but I have to ask you, you are undergoing elective surgery this fall for something very unusual, something on your bucket list, which I would say is probably not on most people's. Would you explain what that is and why you're doing that?
I am donating a kidney. Probably in October. I was actually just okayed for surgery the other day. So they've done all the tests to make sure that I'm good to go. But it's something I've wanted to do for a long time, because there are over 100,000 people in this country waiting for an organ. Living organs are more successful than deceased donor organs. And the truth is that if 1 in 10,000 people decided to becoming a living donor, we could actually eliminate the list of people who are currently waiting for an organ. And it seems like a really small sacrifice on my end to give up. They say share your spare, to give up my spare kidney to help someone else, and to hopefully be a part of that ongoing movement to reduce and erase the wait.
Unfortunately, we are out of time. I want to thank my guest, Oregon State Representative Tiffany Mitchell, for coming into the studio and speaking about her first 7 months in office. Thank you, Representative Mitchell.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Mitchell, a progressive Democrat and recent state social service worker, was elected to the Oregon House of Representatives last November. Her district, number 32, encompasses all of Clatsop County, much of Tillamook County, and a small portion of Washington County. This is Perspectives, and I'm your host, Joan Herman. The show is brought to you in part by a grant from the Clatsop County Cultural Coalition. Perspectives was engineered today by Brian Bovenizer. The show can be heard on the stations of Coast Community Radio, 91.9 Astoria and 89.5 Tillamook. You also can find show podcasts on the station's website. If you would like to contact me, send me an email to perspectives@coastradio.org. Thanks for listening.